Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening if you're in Canada and Toronto, along or somewhere around there with Vicki Delaney. Yep. Also writing is Eva Gates, and I'm holding up her Eva Gates book, Death Knells and Wedding Bells, which is her 50th published book. So, Vicki, a toast to you.
Oh, thank you very much. There we go. I have my tea here.
We have wine, the whole tea. Ooh. And I went back and looked because Poison Pen Press published Vicki, and as I recall, the very first book we published was in 2005, and it was called Scare the Light Away.
That's right.
Yeah, right. You have in your impressive list, this is a list of the 50 books, just in case, but there's one below it called Whiteout, and I can't remember Whiteout. Was that you published?
It was published by a little tiny Canadian press that was so minuscule that I don't count it. So I didn't even count it into my 50 books.
I was pretty sure that I did not edit a book called White. Yeah. I just
no, you definitely
sure.
You didn't. And so when I first published my first book with Poison Pen, Rob felt that he could call Scare the Light Away my debut novel because the other one had never been seen by anybody.
Right. Well, yeah. And it was a really fabulous book. In fact, Vicki wrote 3 non-series books for Poison Pen Press, all of which I thought were remarkable. Scare the Light Away and Burden of Memory, and then More Than Sorrow. Right. And I'm not sure. We have recently discovered a stash of old Poison Pen Press hardcovers. And what we do have are the Constable Molly Smith mysteries, quite a few of them. And the first one of that was called In the Shadow of the Glacier. And a little project for our staff is we're going to, because there's so many books by so many authors, we haven't actually put them all into our inventory, but they're sorted out. So I've asked Jacob, who's going to be joining us in the next day or two, to pull them down and scan them and put them into inventory so that those of you who are fans of Vicki's work can order them. I love the Constable Molly Smith, and I did love the standalone. So Vicki, let's talk. I know we're here to talk about Eva Gates, but let's go back.
To talk about me too.
That's right. Let's go back. 2005. So we've been doing this now for 28 years. Wow. Yep. That's amazing. Yep. Talk to me a little bit about Constable Molly Smith and, you know, why you decided to create, because you did write a series about her.
I did write a series about that. And if you remember, I wrote 2 standalones, Burden of Memory and Scare the Light Away. Mm-hmm. And it was you who said, and before we start this talking too much, I want to say, Barbara, how unbelievably grateful I am to you and to Rob for giving me a chance to start my writing career. And you know, I'm very, very grateful. I owe you guys such a debt. And next time I'm in Arizona, I'll buy you a glass of wine.
Well, thank you. You don't owe us the debt. Actually, I'd Scare the Light Away is, let's talk about that first, because actually that's the first time I really thought about, there's such a wealth now, Vicki, you are way ahead of the curve, because there's this enormous wealth of World War II, pre-war and post-war stories out. And I had never really thought about what would the life of a British war bride who came not to America, but because Vicki is Canadian, who came to Canada and discovered that the family she had married into was not the family that she anticipated. And worse, there was almost no communication channel back to her own family. Transatlantic phone calls cost the earth, transportation, whatever. Yep. So you have a woman who is essentially really isolated and begins to suspect that she may be in, that things are not well and that she might be in really serious danger. And you know, Megan Abbott, Vicki, on Sunday brought a book to us called Beware the Woman, in which the central question is, do you know the person you married? And what is the relation of a child to a parent as versus a child to a spouse? And you dealt with all of that in this book.
And one of the things I wanted to do, so people who aren't familiar with the book, it's a dual storyline, right? There's the story of the mother who was the war bride who came to Canada, and then there's the contemporary story of the daughter who goes home for her mother's funeral. And one of the things I also wanted to do was the difference between the two daughters. The oldest daughter was born in England to this war bride and her Canadian soldier, and came to Canada with her. And the other one was born, well, she's sort of more my age, so she's born in the early 50s. There was an enormous generation gap between those two sisters, that just the times and expectations changed so fast in those seven, mm-hmm. 8, 9 years, the way that girls were brought up. That's something I explored with that too.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of, I mean, that certainly still happens today, young women and young, but you know, you meet somebody and you're brushed off your feet and people say, maybe you should wait longer. And it's, oh, no, it's all, you know, it's, everything's fine. But yes, the fact is that these, anybody in those times, even this is as late as 1945, if you moved from Europe to North America, chances were you'd never see your family again, because people just didn't. You couldn't afford to travel unless you're fairly well off. That's right.
And as I said, long distance phone calls, you know, now we have cell phones and we text each other all around the world, but you couldn't do any of that then.
Yeah, the letter took a couple of weeks to go, you know, back and forth. And some people were in the book, she's reluctant to put down on paper how unpleasant her life is. And it's certainly true, I'm sure American soldiers did it too, that they would meet these English women, and some with malicious intent and some just because they kind of built up a story that they then couldn't pull back, played up how they belong, you know, the big ranch, they had a big ranch where what they had was a hard scrabble farm, you know, and so they played up a lot that these women got to these places all on their own, no friends, no family, no nothing. And it was definitely not what they had been led to believe they were getting themselves into. And there were a lot of very good marriages, but a lot that definitely were not.
I'm sure that's true. And unfortunately, when people meet, you know, in times of danger and suspense, when there's lots of hormones and lots of adrenaline, and no real sense that tomorrow is even going to happen, you know, there are a lot of hasty marriages. I mean, a lot of the war stories that we get to read now, because so many of them are women's stories, revolve around that, you know, that it was like a rush to judgment, or a rush to marriage or whatever it was, or pregnancy. And, you know, and then the war was over, people survived, and, you know, there we all were. But anyway, I thought it was a terrific book, and it is a murder mystery. There is a crime involved, and the dual story structure, I think, is particularly interesting. And then you went on to write, which one is Burden of Memory? Is that Burden the one with Vietnam, or is that the third one?
No, it was a Molly Smith book that's got the Vietnam. Burden of Memory is about the Canadian Army nurse in the Second World War.
Ah, right.
That's right. And she wants to write her memoirs, so she hires a biographer to write her memoirs. Right. That's right. So again, dual storyline is what happened during the war. Someone is afraid that someone doesn't want her memoirs to be written. So you therefore have the dual storyline of what is in the memoirs that somebody will try to stop.
Right. And that's always in crime fiction, the idea of, you know, biographers or ghostwriters sometimes, but in this case, a biographer and memoirs, you know, that are going to leak some information that has been hidden for a long time. It's always a very powerful driver, I think, in crime fiction. And I mean, any connection that there is to books and writing, oftentimes, you know, there's a slight literary element that comes in, is oftentimes really attracts people to, you know, to crime. I mean, there are infinite number of books where mysteries, crime novels, where, you know, books and writing and so forth, diaries, memoirs and all.
Oh, yeah.
Are central to the plot. And then there was one more, More Than Sorrow.
More Than Sorrow? More Than Sorrow is about I'm trying to get my words right here. A contemporary woman who was a journalist in Afghanistan. She was injured, suffered a brain injury in Afghanistan, IED explosion. So she goes to her sister's farm to recover. And while she's there, she's worried that she's having visions of the original settlers to the farm. So the story of the original settlers to the farm, who were refugees from the American Revolution, is the story that runs through it. Because where I live, Prince Edward County, Ontario, we call ourselves a proud loyalist town. So it was settled in 1793 by people who fled the American Revolution.
Hey, so I was just jumping with the Vietnam thing. That's actually a thing that happened before. Was the loyalists who didn't want to live under the American Revolution in the new United States moved to Canada. And You know, I've always thought that was so interesting. We were in Newfoundland on a cruise some years ago. I discovered that Newfoundland actually had a chance to vote to join the United States and instead ended up with Canada. So, you know, just because this is the way it is at the moment doesn't mean that, you know, it was always that way or it was written in stone. Anyway, these were three absolutely terrific books. And I learned so much in working with Vicki on them. The stories were great. For those of you who are reading her long line of cozy mysteries and Sherlock Holmes mysteries, it may come as a surprise to you that these are pretty dark women's stories. You know, there's a lot of and a lot of contemporary issues in them. As I say, the Megan Abbott book, Beware the Woman, that just came out, could easily be the same thing as Scare the Light Away. Yeah. Just amazingly so. Anyway, then we got to Constable Molly Smith, and you wrote a whole series about her, and I loved her. So let's talk about Constable Molly.
And that came about because I had done the first two standalones for you, and then you said to me, why didn't I try my hand at a series? And at that time, I was working in Toronto, downtown Toronto, in a big office tower for a bank. And I thought, you know, I could write a book set in a downtown office tower in Toronto, but I'd rather set it someplace that I'd like to mentally visit, you know, when I can. And one of my daughters still lives there. So I still go there regularly to the little town of Nelson, BC. And I absolutely love it there. So I thought that would be a good place, and it is a good place for set, aside from the fact that I love it. It's a very unique town. When I was in Sedona, Arizona, a couple of times, a woman that I met, bookstore owner, Chris Neary, I think was her name, in Sedona.
She was an author that she and her husband started a little bookstore. It didn't last for a long time, but she was there briefly, right.
And she said to me how much Nelson, and I call it in the books, I call it Trafalgar, how much it reminded her of Sedona. You get those same sort of, you know, the modern day hippies, the new age people all, you know, looking for, you know, for living in the woods and tinkling their little bells and their incense and all that kind of stuff. So a place where you have a lot of people coming in. So you automatically have conflict between the older people that have lived there and had jobs and, you know, raised families and all that. And then these young people that are coming, a lot of whom are idealistic, and they come kind of forgetting that they need to get a job and they need to live someplace too. So they're a little lost when they get there because they think they're going to camp in the woods and, you know, Canada in the winter.
Yeah, but because it's winter, you've got the whole sort of ski, you know, the ski group.
The and then you have the whole ski thing.
Professionals, yeah.
Which varies between the, you know, the high money people that can afford to, you know, go on a ski vacation and the people that are just ski bums and that. And so you have a town that has that kind of a almost built-in conflict between the different types of people, not violent conflict, but just that people, expectations of life are different.
Like Aspen or Crested Butte or, you know, some of the Colorado towns, as you say. And part of the problem is that the locals get pushed out by, or at least overcome financially by the incomers. And then any real tourist destination, you know, honestly, Vicki, the pandemic has just changed Scottsdale. I mean, our you know, immigration rate here in Scottsdale was phenomenal during the pandemic. And so we went from a reasonably small sized city to this, you know, and it's very hard to, you know, to integrate the newcomers and the older people. We're losing the old Scottsdale, you know, the sort of old Western town, the horse ranches. People can't afford the taxes. They're being mowed down by developers that want to put up like 1,000 condos. You know, we see that in Barcelona and Venice and on the Croatian coast and any place, Cusco, Peru, you know, where there's a huge influx of tourists. So a town like Nelson is incredibly,
And it's also interesting sort of for a point of view of writing fiction too, because in real life, and I transferred it into my town, Trafalgar, it's actually like it's not on the way to anywhere. You would never pass through Nelson. You need to be going to Nelson.
Right.
So it's got that. So, and it's in this valley. It's quite steep, the mountains on either side and the valley and the river runs through. You know, many reasons why I decided to set the book there, but the sort of geographical description is good to write about, and also the isolation of what's a good size city, 10,000 people, you know, with outskirts, but it's still isolated physically in that way.
So Molly is the constable, which is kind of the lower rungs on the local law enforcement. The terms are slightly different in Canada than they're in the United States, but still, it's the same thing. And, you know, Molly has a family. She has romantic interests. She has interesting crimes to solve. It was a wonderful series. I really loved it. And I was sad when, you know, you moved into writing different things. But I understand that, you know, writing a series is a big commitment, and maybe you just run out of steam after so many books.
Well, I probably get two emails a week from people asking me if there's going to be another Molly Smith book. And I always just have to say, you know, I just don't have the time right now. But part of it, like, I'm enjoying writing the cold season now. And in a way, it's kind of like there was a lot of angst in some of those darker books. And in one of the Molly Smith books, I remember a line I always quote when I'm talking about why I write cozies. She says to some visiting police inspector from someplace or other, she says, when I decided to become a cop, I knew I'd deal with the hard things in life, traffic accident victims, you know, abused children, missing children, abused women. But that's not the worst of it, is it? The worst of it is the sheer tragedy of some people's lives. You know, and I dealt with that a bit. And it's nice in the cozies that people don't have tragic lives. Unfortunate things, I get dead guy here on the floor, you know, that's too bad. But the lives aren't tragic in that same way.
So. I'm sure, no, I know that's true. And I know there are devoted readers of cozies. And part of the reason is that it's comfort reading for those very reasons.
I got a lot of emails over, particularly the first year of the pandemic, from people saying how they were enjoying reading my books because they needed a break from, you know, the endless depressing news and that sort of stuff. And they really found escape in cozy books.
That's absolutely true. And currently we're having a renaissance, to be British, of historical fiction, because, you know, it's a lot safer when you know how everything came out. I think that's one of the reasons for this enormous spate of World War II mysteries. I mean, okay. I'm getting to the point where if I have to read one more story about, you know, whatever facet, I mean, it was a global war and almost everybody was involved, and there are infinite stories, personal stories about civilians, about parents, about, you know, it's not just war stories. There's just this whole panoply of things that you can write about the Second World War. And, you know, we know how it came out, and it's a war where there was a clearly good side and a bad side. I remember Ken Follett talking about that at a Thriller Fest. You know, why is it that people continue to write about World War II? And he said that, you know, there are really no shades of gray in World War II.
Yeah.
World War One is just like a clusterfuck, you know? I mean, there's nothing great about World War One or many other, but World War II, you know, pretty clear. And so it's a safe thing to write about. Bridgerton has brought back, I think, a real interest in earlier periods, for example. There's a whole Regency revival going on. And that's a lot of fun. It's one of my very favorite periods. I didn't think that Bridgerton's particularly authentic. But it's worth watching for the clothes. My view of Bridgerton is that the costume people deserve all the credit.
I mean,
astonishing. But still, it's comfort reading too. And, you know, to read about the conflicts and the other things that happened in a time where we know how it came out. So you have written, if I get all this right here, year-round Christmas mysteries, Sherlock Holmes bookshop mysteries. I'm not quite sure what Ashley Grant is. I've missed the Ashley Grant mysteries. What are those?
Yeah, those are actually novellas that I wrote for adult literacy. And I wrote most of those when I was still writing for Poison Pen, you might remember, because I did talk to you about it. So the Ashley Grant ones and the Ray Robertson mysteries are novellas, and they were specifically written for adults with low literacy skills.
You know, I'd totally forgotten it, Vicki. Thank you for reminding me.
And unfortunately, it's Orca is the publisher, big, well-known Canadian children's and YA publisher. And they dropped that line, that the adult literacy stuff, they had high hopes for that, and they just couldn't make it though. So they've dropped, their line is over now. And I really, it's not just, I really enjoyed writing those books, and I really felt that I believed in what they were doing. Because, you know, adults who don't read, they're embarrassed to be seen reading children's books, right? You know, so these books were adult themes, adult covers, adult titles, and dealt with adult issues and all that, but they were written at a grade sort of 2 to 3 level.
Sure.
And then
go ahead.
As a writer, that was actually really interesting to do too, because I kind of, it was almost like a, like an exercise in stripping a novel down to its absolute essence. They were about 20,000 words, 15 to 20,000 words. So, but you had to have a fully complete plot. You had to have interesting characters in a nice setting, but you didn't have all the stuff that goes, you know, with no subplots, no flash forwards, no flashbacks, nothing like that. It was just the bare bones of a plot. And I found that challenging to do, but really worthwhile.
Tell me about the Klondike Gold Rush mysteries, because you wrote 2-4 of those, all of which had gold in the title. That's and those were not Poison Pen Press books.
Those were Dundurn, Canadian publisher named Dundurn. Yeah, I wrote 4 of those. Those were quite light. Klondike Gold Rush was fun. You know, 18, well, it wasn't fun to people there. It was fun to write about 1898 in Dawson City. So you had the historical aspect. But in real life, it was just an amazing time. You had all these people charged up through the wilderness, carrying a year's worth of supplies on their backs. By the time almost all of them got there, it was too late. The good, you know, the good claims had all been taken. And so it was the people that made the money were the ones that mined the miners, in particular dance halls and people around the, you know, the gambling casinos and all that. They were the ones that made the money.
For the Bordeaux. So
yeah, and that too. So my character is a dance hall owner of a mysterious background who's sort of on the run from forces of law and order. And those books were intended to be light and funny. I just told them a madcap romp they were.
Yeah. Right. I like Dundurn Press. I think they've done some interesting things.
They're still around.
Like you said, a small Canadian publisher and have done some really good work. I wish there were more movement between Canadian publishers and the American audience. I mean, they do have some distribution here now, which was harder to come by a long time ago, but, you know, hooray for it. And I'm trying to think, Ian Hamilton's publisher, why can't I think of the name?
Anansi.
Anansi, thank you. Yep. They have had a lot more American market penetration, let's say. And then there's one that starts with E. I keep wanting
ECW
Press. Yep. And they did a really good series that is set in Western Canada, and I thought was terrific. And there's also a birding series that I like. So I kind of wish that, you know, we Americans were more familiar with some of the smaller presses. You know, the Canadian authors that most Americans know are published in America, you know, you being one, the late Peter Robinson, you know, Louise Penny. I love Robert Pobie's books, you know. So anyway, I can't quite fix that, but I do urge many of you to watching this, that you might want to look for books that are specifically published by the smaller Canadian presses, then they do some wonderful work. Anyway, then so when you've got 3 cozy series going, in this Eva Gates book, because this is under a pseudonym, is the in the Lighthouse Library mystery series. So what inspires you? Why year round Christmas mysteries? Let's start with that one and go from there.
The year round Christmas mysteries, just fun, you know. When I talk to people about cozies, I usually use the word fun a lot. So my intention is to have fun with these. They're intended to be funny. They're intended to not be taken too seriously. And so that was my agent's idea. Was actually said, well, you know, maybe what about a series where a customer owns or the character owns a Christmas store? And I thought, it's kind of mundane, why don't we make it a Christmas town? So it's a town called Rudolph, New York, where they call themselves, you know, America's Christmas town, your year-round Christmas destination. So I try, you know, there's a fine line too between having fun with it and going overboard. I try not to make it too terribly saccharine and just too ridiculously sweet. But the theme of the town is Christmas, and you have Murder and Mayhem comes to town at Christmas time, right? In the first book of the Santa Claus Parade, the character's float is sabotaged. I mean, who sabotages the float in the Santa Claus Parade, right? So it's all just fun.
No, I understand that. But I mean, in a way, writing cozies is a variation on world building that happens in science fiction writing. Because, I mean, sometimes this one is actually on the Outer Banks and around Nag's Head and so it's a real place. But something like, you know, Rudolph, New York basically requires world building in the sense that you have to create the town. You don't have to go, I mean, in science fiction, oftentimes you have to start at the very basics. You know, you have to do geography, you have to come up with ethics and a belief system and religion and finances and politics, the whole nine yards. So you don't really have to do all of that for a small town in New York, but nevertheless, you have to decide, you know, how to design it, how to populate it. So is that an easy exercise for you?
I think it was. I sort of thought, Jingle Bell Lane is the name of the main store. Again, Main Street, trying not to make it too cutesy, but I still want, like, the main character's husband, or father, rather, is the driver behind sort of how they converted this dying, upstate New York town into this big, successful tourist town. And so the backstory of it all, I kind of drew all that, too, about... they took advantage of the name Rudolph, which I specifically made up, of course, so that they, in fact, took advantage of the name, that it had a historical name after the Rudolph family, which is a little bit of history there, too. And then they, what can we do, you know, this dying town? So it's a little bit of, there are the same where I live, too. There are, you know, little dying industrial towns all over the place. And some of them need some imagination to, you know, to get a spark, to bring them back, bring people coming and that sort of thing. So that's sort of what happened in Rudolph. And they were able to take advantage of the name and they turned it into a year-round Christmas town. It's all working out for them right now. So yeah, I played with that more and more as I went on.
I totally get it. But I mean, most cozies end up with some sort of small, usually they're a small town because cozies don't fit terribly well into an urban setting, although it's not impossible. And usually there is some sort of business or profession or something. Oftentimes it's a bookstore, and then we almost infinite number of cozies that involve bookstores. And I'm here to tell you that it is totally unbelievable from the standpoint of running a bookstore that you would have 5 minutes to leave your bookstore, especially in a small town where you didn't have any help, and go off and solve crimes. But I used to have that conversation with Joan Hiss, who wrote a very successful bookstore. Anyway, I mean, you know, it can be a chocolate share on the shores of Lake Michigan. It can be a candle making operation in Akron, Ohio, whatever. So usually there is some professional or commercial aspect that is involved. And then generally there is going to be a person solving the crimes who either has some particular expertise or has a personal stake in what happens. They're going to be defending somebody they care about, or they're going to be defending their business. You know, Joanne Fluke, for example, has made an absolute killing with a bakery in Lake Eden, Minnesota. I'm going to be doing her book launch for which we've been happily doing with Joanne now for like at least 10 years. It's the only thing she really does. And it's great, you know, but there you have to really suspend disbelief to believe that the baker Hannah Swenson in small town Lake Eden, Minnesota is consistently solving mysteries. So,
that's right.
You know, there is, it requires the reader to kind of make a leap of faith you know, that. Yeah.
But don't you think that an awful lot of fiction is like that too? I mean, like, I know some police officers and the entire career, they've never met a master criminal.
Right. No, they all totally agree with you that, you know, there's a complicity between the reader and the writer. And, you know, there's a big comfort factor in going back to Lake Eaton. You know, it's a place where, you know the people, you know the bakery, there's always recipes in it. And Joanne has some really hilarious stories about, you know, the recipes, which are a feature in what are called, their subgenres of cozies, one of which is the culinary cozy.
Right.
And then the culinary cozies usually offer the reader recipes. Recipes actually are almost the most dangerous thing that a writer can produce. There are legal ramifications to recipes that most of people would not think of. You can
make
people ill, you can harm people. People can do remarkably stupid things, as Joanne has pointed out. Did I ever tell you the story about the pressure cooker? It's my personal favorite of all Joanne's stories. So, you know, you would not think this was possible. But in one of her books earlier on, she had a recipe for a dish in a pressure cooker. And I don't remember what all the ingredients are, but one of them was a number 10 can of small peas. So the recipe reads, you know, let's say like, you know, two chicken breasts and, you know, three potatoes and an onion and a can of small peas and something or other, put it in the pressure cooker and, you know, an hour, whatever it is.
I can see where this is going. Woman
actually put the can of small peas in the pressure cooker, which then blew up and really injured her. So now Joanne's recipes read, open one can and pour it into, I'm serious, you know. And so you wouldn't expect that there could be landmines like that, you know, in recipes and books. But the truth is there are.
Well, I actually don't have one. There we go. My series from Kensington, the Tea by the Sea Mysteries, has recipes in it. But I will keep that in mind. I have no pressure cooker.
Well, you really do have to be extremely careful. People who publish cookbooks, you know, have big test kitchen operations to make sure that, and, you know, some recipes have to come with warnings, you know, like, don't do this if you have a peanut allergy, or, you know, we've all become very conscious of eating can be dangerous. Cooking can be dangerous.
And all my recipes in my book are stuff I've made in my kitchen. So I don't have a big industrial kitchen with, you know.
No, I know. But I was just pointing out to you that there are potential hazards for doing stuff like that. But, you know, that's something in your, as you point out in your Tea by the Sea Mysteries, do you think readers expect recipes to come with the books?
I don't know if it's, they like it. Certainly readers who like it. Right. I have been asked why there's no recipe in the Sherlock Holmes bookshop series. The secondary character owns Mrs. Hudson's tea room. I've been asked quite a few times why there's no recipes in that book, and that's because it's not intended to be a culinary cozy, right?
Right.
But certainly, I mean, you know, publishers wouldn't do it if they didn't think it sold books.
Oh, it does sell books. No. I think that is an expectation that in the quote culinary subgenre, you know, people do in part. I know that people buy Joanne's books in part for the recipes. Yeah. And
it can be a marketing and advertising tool too. Like I've had, Kensington has had a recipe of mine put in Tea Time magazine a couple of times. It's actually a whole page of the recipe from my book with a picture of the book and a little description of the book. So you're hitting a very specific audience in Tea Time magazine.
You definitely are. And I think in some of the library, because library and bookshop, I should have mentioned that that's a whole subgenre. I mean, there's an antiques one, and which I really enjoy. I think the antiques cozies are great because they usually have some interesting history in them and all sorts of stuff. There's a library, maybe that's distinguished from the bookshop, but anyway. So it's bookish. And I think that people who buy those often buy or look forward to reading recommendations, you know. So is that a part of your Library Lighthouse series, as you like to include books? I mean, real books, not your books, but real books.
in that series, it's getting a little bit less. I think I did it a little bit at the beginning, and I don't do it so much anymore. Where I really do have a lot of books in it is my Sherlock Holmes bookshop series.
Right.
There, I mention a lot of books, maybe 4 or 5 or 6, like per book. It sort of suits the bookshop that, you know, she's there working in the bookshop. A customer comes in and said, you know, I would like to get a gift for my 12-year-old niece. Oh, have you read, you know, such and such a series by such and such? And then the Sherlock Holmes bookshop too, not just books, but merchandise. And that's, to me, that was a whole new world about, you know, you could have a Sherlock Holmes themed bookstore and with all the stuff. It's amazing how much Sherlock stuff there is out there in the world. Tea towels, thimbles, you know, puzzles, games, t-shirts, everything imaginable. I have a pair of socks. I bought them at Poison Pen. I did buy a couple of years ago. I bought a pair of Sherlock Holmes socks.
Yeah, bookstores carry stuff like that. And, you know, in the children's fiction world, there's a whole industry of like Pete the Cat. Pete the Cat has his own merchandise line, you know, it's just wonderful. And, you know, in that, There are plenty of authors who've had hit books, you know, who've actually made more money off the merchandise rights than they have off the books. So we'll see. But I wondered, you know, when you write the Lighthouse Mysteries, if, you know, part of the fun is incorporating real books into the story structure.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. So in the Lighthouse Library series, every book, the book that the Classic Novel Reading Club is reading is loosely forms part of the plot. I mean, I don't mean it's derivative or anything like that, but there is something in the classic novel or some things that, you know, and the one where they're reading The Hound of the Baskervilles, my character is given this dog to look after that she doesn't want to look after, this yippy little dog that doesn't get after a cat. But at the climax, you know, the dog sort of, spoiler alert, saves the day. And she says, you know, just like The Hound of the Baskervilles, who didn't save the day, but that doesn't matter. but I like to do that for two reasons. It's fun for me, and it gets me reading some classic books that I haven't read in a long, long time. Sometimes I struggle a little bit because I have to have a little bit of an idea of what I want and then look for a classic book that will reflect it loosely, very loosely. And also in every one of the books, the book club meets to discuss the book. And something of importance plot-wise happens in that meeting. Somebody makes a reference to something, you know, somebody meets somebody new, all that sort of stuff. So the threads are quite strong. And a lot of my readers, I do tell them ahead of time what the book is going to be, because a lot of my readers like to read the classic novel before they read the Lighthouse Library book.
Sure, it makes perfectly good sense. You remember Carolyn Hart in the Death on Demand series? You know,
yes, I do.
Was there a book club? But one of her, I'll use it in the proper sense of the word. One of the conceits of that series was that there was somebody who regularly did a series of drawings or paintings.
That's right.
And it became a contest.
People would guess.
Yep.
Yes, that's
you
right.
You had to guess what each painting, what book it might relate to. And that was a lot of fun. And it reminded me, Vicki, many, many years ago, Rob and I, God, it was in 1990, it really was a long time ago, went to the Agatha Christie Centenary in Torquay. And as part of that, on Sunday morning before we went to visit her house at Greenways, the local church had a flower show. And each of the flower arrangements on that Sunday had to be it had to be derived from one of Agatha Christie's books. And when you went in, they gave you like a scorecard, you know, and you had to identify which book went with which flower arrangement, and the person who got the most correct titles and so forth got some sort of a prize. So the mirror cracked was the easiest one. That is the one that I remember most clearly, you know, because it wasn't that hard. Some of them were really
pretty obscure.
But it made me realize, you know, that that Carolyn's idea, you know, of the paintings was very similar, if you think about it, you know,
yes.
Idea of having the flower arrangements that you had to decode, so to speak, and attach to whatever book it might happen to be. So I think mystery readers really like solving little puzzles, you know, they're a challenge, and that's really fun.
Yep. I kind of I do think of a cozy as, to me, it is a cozy should be a puzzle mystery, in the way that a, you know, a traditional mystery where you have almost the game of wits between the author and the reader, that the author has to lay down the clues in such a way that the astute reader has a chance of solving the mystery at or slightly before the protagonist. And along with that is all, that's why you need all the red herrings and the false clues and the distractions and everything like that.
And there's a sense of fair play involved, you know, in that all of that needs to be in reasonably plain sight. So it doesn't, you know, you can't bring in the bad guy at, you know, the penalty.
Bad wife in the attic.
You just can't do that. So I've always thought that was so interesting that Patricia Cornwell's first book, Postmortem, which was such an enormous success. Actually, she did that. The bad guy didn't appear until something like page 285. You had no chance to identify him as a reader. But that it was a thriller more than it was a puzzle mystery. And so, you know, it didn't seem to matter much. But I've always thought that was really interesting. And one of the rules for fair playing mysteries, if you go back and look at the Golden Age, was no doppelgangers. And yet in the first Charles Todd mystery, A Test of Wills, there was a doppelganger, which was taboo. And another was no Chinaman, you know. that was sort of a shorthand for, you know, you couldn't bring in, I think, the Moonstone, you know, you couldn't bring in like somebody from some exotic country with an agenda that nobody could imagine.
The Moonstone is one of the books in one of the Lighthouse Library books, A Death Long Overdue, I think. The Moonstone is the book that that they're reading. Because I like that book a lot.
Yep. I do too. And, you know, and I always love The Woman in White, which, you know, involves, you know, female incarceration and, you know, locking up women for advantage and just all sorts of contemporary issues, really, if you think about it. Wilkie Collins, I mean, a madhouse was a place where it was easy to stash unwanted or females or females that wouldn't behave or females who had money that you wanted to take or various things. And there wasn't a lot of defense from them. So I love crime fiction in that it explores a lot of social issues, even in the cozy, you know, which is maybe the lightest form of it. You can still explore an awful lot of social issues. So let's talk about the Lighthouse mystery, this particular one. Why are you in the Outer Banks? I mean, that's a really interesting part of the country, which is currently being eroded. So, you know, how long is your lighthouse really going to last?
Well, because I'm not that one. One of the other lighthouses down there has actually been moved because it was about to fall into the sea. One of the other ones, I forget which one. This book was a work for hire for me. I was approached by Penguin, a bit of a story, if you don't mind me relating it. One of my daughters is a paramedic, and she worked in the Turks and Caicos Islands for a year and a half. And I went down and visited her a couple times. And it was just sort of a fish out of water kind of story, this girl from Toronto working in Turks and Caicos, which is, Caribbean island. And I thought that would make an interesting idea for a series. So I sort of thought, I came up with a bit of a proposal. And I approached my friend, Mary Jane Maffini, who a lot of your readers will know, to ask if she'd show it to her agent. And she did show it to her agent. And her agent said that she didn't think she would have a market for it. She passed it. I did give it to you, and you also passed on it. So that was the end of that. And that series, you know, that didn't happen. But then when this agent, Kim Leonetti at Bookends, she got the offer of Penguin was looking for a work for hire for the Lighthouse Library series. And she remembered that she had liked my work, what she'd seen. Mm-hmm. So she contacted me and asked if I'd be interested in taking this on. So that's how that came about. So the thing about a work for hire is, you know it for sure, but maybe not all your readers do, that the publisher actually comes up with the idea as opposed to the usual one where an author presents a book to a publisher. So they had the idea of the Outer Banks and setting the library in the Bawdy Island Lighthouse itself. So they presented me with that and gave me that to work with. So that's why it's in the Outer Banks, where I had never been until I started writing a book. So I thought I'd better go down and have a look. So also, I always say, I don't believe in write what you know, I believe write what you want to know.
Why not? I agree. And oftentimes in work for hire, they actually own the author's name too. So was Eva Gates a proprietary name for them, or did you get to make it up?
That's right. That is, Eva Gates is, that's why it's a pen name. And the editor and I worked, it was hard. It was really hard to come up with a name. The name that's not, you know, nobody else has been used, the name that's easy to remember, that's not hard to spell. Anyway, so we did that. So that they work for hire, they also own the copyright. So when right. this series was, there were three books published by Penguin and they discontinued it. And I thought that was the end of that because they never, almost never give the copyright to the author. And they did, they gave it to me and it's now published by Crooked Lane. And Crooked Lane said to me, did I want to start using my own name? And I thought that would just be too confusing to have a different name from the same series of books.
Right, so now I can see that. Actually, Crooked Lane took in quite a few. There were a great many work series for hire, cozy mysteries that were published for a while by Penguin. And then they did a reorganization and they yep. shed hundreds of them. And Crooked Lane, your current publisher, actually yep. took a lot of them. And so probably that was a reason why it was relatively easy, you know, for the copyright to pass over yeah. because they didn't intend to use it again at yeah. Penguin. And there were a number of people who would benefit from having their series continued.
Penguin themselves benefits from it because Penguin right. still owns the first three books and those exactly. books sell really well.
Yeah.
You know, particularly when a new one comes out, the first one does really well.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, it was a way to keep what we call in the book trade, the backlist or the earlier books alive without the burden of publishing the new book, you know, which they passed on to somebody else. So there's a lot of symbiosis in publishing. And, you know, that's a good thing for readers because, you know, if you were fond of the series, you didn't really want it to end. And it was nice that it got handed off to somebody else. I mean, one of the real tragedies for readers is, you know, when an author either dies or retires, the character does too. And right now we're in an era of legacy publishing where authors who have been beloved and have characters that people don't want to say goodbye to, somebody, not the author, not the original author anyway, is coming in to write. The most recent example of that is Brett Battles, who has taken up Stuart Wood's Stone Barrington series. That book just came out in June. And Monday night, we just did an event for one of Clive Cussler's legacy authors, Mike Madden, who I think writes wonderful books. So it's a boon for readers when a beloved character does not go into the grave or retirement with the author. And, you know, you have to think about that. But so do you own the copyright now to the yes. Lighthouse Library series?
Yeah, I do own it now. Yeah.
Okay, great. So with all this going on, how many books comfortably are you writing a year? I mean, in terms of your own time and having a life.
Yeah, 4 books a year now. So I have contracts for 4 books a year. I do seem to, you know, seem to manage to have a life. I don't know. You know, it's working out. It's working out okay for me. So hopefully it still will for a while.
You're a fast writer. You've always been a fast writer. Not everybody is. Yeah. Yeah. And you don't lack for ideas. So, you know, but 4 books a year, that's a lot, Vicki.
I'm struggling a little bit, not much with the idea for the concept of think, you know, this book is going to be about art theft, for example, blah, blah. But to me, to try and get a different way of the character, you know, having the brilliant idea that makes her realize who the killer is, the confrontation, how many times can she struggle at the edge of a cliff with the bad guy? And how many times can she be driving down a dark road and her cell phone battery has run out? And those are the sort of things I'm struggling with now to try and come up with different ways of, right. of plot twists, of climaxes and all that sort of stuff. So,
You're right. I mean, you know, there's actually, well, there may be an unlimited number of ways to do that, but at some point, I think there's always the chance that you're going to repeat something. But
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, readers are pretty much okay with that, and it's not necessarily the case, although you might not want to hear this, but not every reader maybe is reading the Lighthouse series and the Sherlock Holmes series.
That's well, I mean, that's fine, right? Yeah, so
Well,
I'm
but so
still for myself.
you can have some repetition without necessarily annoying the reader, because you know, I think that people tend to follow their own interests, and you know, I don't know that cozy readers read everything. You know, they may align, as I said, to the culinary or the antique. I myself am drawn to antique cozies. I love antiques. I love the history part, and so I tend to read you know, cozies that involve, and there are several of them that involve people in the antiques trade, for example.
Okay.
I really like.
Well, this book, Steve for Malice, if you look here, Steve in Malice, is you see Peter Rabbit there. The
Okay.
character buys a antique Peter Rabbit tea chest, and she goes to an antique store. She finds this Peter Rabbit complete Peter Rabbit children's tea set in a wicker box. She buys it. She takes it back to the store, and needless to say, somebody is looking for
Somebody is
it.
right. So just to, you know, in case we keep losing track of this
Right,
book,
right.
Death Knells and Wedding Bells. So we're in the Outer Banks, and librarian Lucy, who's the lead character in this thing, is finally going to get married. Now, you know for an absolute certainty when a cozy starts out with a wedding that something is just going to screw up the wedding. I mean, it almost never is going to go smoothly, because that's going to be part of the plot engine. And it's amazing how weddings can produce conflicts, isn't it?
It is. You think you've got all those, and in real life, wedding bring conflict. You get those, the divorced husband, the divorced couple, and the brother and sister haven't spoken to each other in 20 years, and the blah blah blah. I actually quite consciously wanted the wedding to go fine, so the wedding goes perfectly well. Everything's lovely at the wedding until the next day.
Right. And
Then
that's a
real.
variation, you know, is the wedding's okay, but the honeymoon just gets completely shut down. And there's a very nice gal, Carlene O'Connor, who writes a
Oh yeah,
cozy
I know.
Irish
I know.
series. And I knew that in the wedding series, when the book opened, that the wedding was going to go right down the drain, when a crime is going to interrupt it. And that, you know, it's a cozy. So in the end, you want the wedding to be successful. One of the challenges in writing a long-term cozy series, I think, is the romance. You know, at what point do you either split them up or, you know, put them together? And if it's a cozy, they probably aren't just going to shack up. They're probably actually going to get married. And so, you know, there
Yeah,
you are.
because I'm sort of thinking this is the 10th book in the series, and they've just gotten married, and I'm sort of thinking, well, in sort of a normal lifestyle sort of thing, that this sort of a character would probably want to have children.
Right.
And at the beginning it's established that she's in her early 30s, but I kind of that's not something I want to do. I don't want to have a character juggling a baby
Right.
and a job and chasing bad guys at the same time. I don't think I could juggle mentally in my story. So that's something I'm going to have to decide what I'm going to do, because I don't think that, how do I sort of gloss over the fact that she's the type that would probably want to have children, but I don't want her to have children, and I am the
Well, you
boss.
know, it's an interesting decision. I did an event with Catherine Hall Page, whose, you know, Body
Oh,
and
okay.
the series is a classic cozy series. And when she wrote The Body and the Belfry, which was a huge cozy success and won awards and so forth, it was controversial because Faith actually did have a baby, and there was a huge amount of criticism about whether she could knowingly put herself in danger, knowingly put the
Yeah.
baby in danger. And you know, that comes up a lot with women and young children, is, you know, to what degree is a young mother you know, irresponsible or whatever it is. That comes up even in cop novels and hard-boiled novels. You know, what happens if the, you know, the woman chasing the serial killers and stuff, what happens if she suddenly has children, you know? And so I think you're right. That's a problem to resolve. especially with an older one, you can't just like put it off, you know, and say, well, I'm 22, so I don't have to think about this for a while.
Yeah,
I'm sure you do. And you know what? Series come to an end. You've already brought series to an end. And maybe they'll go off into the sunset and there'll be a new librarian at the Bodie Lighthouse. That's always a possibility.
That's a possibility. That's actually a definite possibility. Yes.
Yeah, why not? You know, lots, I mean, that happens in real life, that, you know, people take jobs and then, you know, people leave jobs and new people take jobs, but the institution stays. So I guess a question for you would be, is this Lucy's series or is this really the Lighthouse Library series, in which case you can, in fact, change things up?
I think that's a good idea. I'm going to give that some thought.
You're welcome. So let's call Jacob up to see if there are any questions from the audience. And remember that we do have some Poison Pen Press books that are no longer readily available that Vicki wrote. And for those of you who'd like to pursue them, you can check on what you got there, Jake. You found a bunch? Oh, looky there. Right, so we'll get them into our inventory so you can find them on our website in the next couple of days, and you can order them while they last. They're not going to be a renewable resource. I mean, this is it.
Oh, so, yeah.
So when they go up there and they sell, that's it. Yeah. Right, Jacob, any questions from anybody?
We do have a few. What was your first story that you ever read? Can you remember your first story?
My first story was a short story, as most authors, I think, do. And I think it's actually, you know, good advice to sort of test yourself out by writing a short story. I wrote a short story called My Seat. And it was the days when I used to take the commuter train into Toronto to work every day. And I always had a seat. You know, I'm a creature of habit. I have a seat that I sat in, and that was my seat. And I wrote this story about this character who gets, and somebody has taken her seat. day goes by, somebody's in her seat. She's getting more and more agitated. And so it was called My Seat. And it was a runner up, I think, at the Bloody Words Mystery Conference 1 year. So it's actually been published in the Bloody Words Anthology, which name I forget. If this person particularly wants to read it, have them write to me and I will tell them where they can find it.
Okay, great. I love that concept. And you're so right, how people really are territorial. This is amazing.
The second half of that question was, have you always wanted to be an author?
No. My career was in computers. I was a computer programmer from way, way back. And then I was a systems analyst. And I really, really liked being a computer programmer in the old days. It was a great job, and the skill, I just loved it. And I worked for a big bank, and things got more complex and it became more and more people involved, and technology of course started changing so fast, and I was very, very bored with my job in the last 7 to 8 years that I was working at the bank. So I sort of thought, well, what could I do that, you know, would be something I could do, make a little extra money, and maybe I could write a book. So I wrote a book.
As one does.
I did take creative writing courses. When I was still working at the bank, I went to my local community college in the evening and took creative writing courses. And learned how to do it. Came from there.
Yeah. Do you still use what you learned in those courses? Did those help get you, jumpstart you into?
Oh, I do, because I think the thing I think Stephen King said that you can't really teach talent, but what you're doing in creative writing courses is learning the craft, so to speak, how to structure a sentence, where to start your novel, at the right spot, how to integrate dialogue, how to, the classic three-act structure, how you want the rising tension to go, and then the falling and then rising again and all that. I think all that should be taught in a good creative writing course, and that's not something that somebody instinctively knows. I've done some. I don't do anymore. I don't really have time. But I used to give creative writing classes myself through my local library. And one thing I see over and over again is somebody would have a really good concept, but just the beginning would just be a background dump. Mm. That's the sort of thing that you need to learn in a creative writing class that don't start with all that background.
Right. That's what I didn't understand. Anything else, Jake?
One more. Do you have any favorite contemporary authors or any favorite books that you've read recently?
I certainly do. I really like, actually, I like the kind of stuff we alluded to a little bit at the beginning, the sort of standalone domestic or psychological suspense that's being so popular right now. So I've just finished the new one by Jane Harper, Exiles,
yeah,
set in Australia. And there's some really good stuff in Australia right now. There's that one. Kate Morton, who I really like. I really like Kate Morton, her earlier books, very much the sort of gothic thing, in a way, almost kind of like More Than Sorrow, with the whole sort of, you know, interweaving of the goth, the old house and the gossip and all that, gothic. And her new one is Homecoming, also set in Australia. So it's quite different, but I liked it a lot. It had its faults, but she's a very good writer, so I liked that. So there's definitely some good crime fiction coming out of Australia right now.
Very good. I agree with you entirely. I've been talking about the Australian crime wave for some time.
Yep. Yep.
Bunch of good writers from Australia. And Australia also now has sort of its own publishing industry. For a long time, it was just an extension of, you know, British publishing. But now there are good Australian presses, and it's made a big difference, I think.
And there's lots of good Canadian crime writing being written right now. My good friend Barbara Fredkin has a new book just came out called Wreck Bay, that's set on Victoria Island, Vancouver Island, which is really great. But it's too bad we can't do what the Australians are doing, who do seem to have been making a real big mark lately. But there is lots of really good Canadian crime fiction out there.
There are, absolutely true. I keep hoping the tariff barriers will recede. You know, the protectionist barrier that Canada has,
yeah,
theory to protect its own publishing industry, but in my opinion, it works against it. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
I can't, for example, send books to Canada for Vicky to sign. It's impossible because there is a huge import tax that goes on. And so Canadian authors who want to sell well in the United States actually have to come to the United States in order to overcome it.
I'll let you know next time. It's too late now because I'm going actually this weekend to Oakmont, Pennsylvania.
To you are. I saw that you were going to be doing that. And that, you know, that looked like a really Kensington had put together several authors to do a program. And I'm so envious because they have the Carnegie Library there. They can do that. And unfortunately, our local library doesn't work that way. So it would be very nice if we had a library partnership, but currently that is not available.
Well, anyway,
is that it, Jake?
That's it.
Wonderful. Great. Well, Vicky, what an honor to spend time with you in connection with your 50th book. And I am so pleased that Poison Pen Press was able to actually jumpstart your career. I love working with you, and I've always enjoyed your work. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And I will definitely try and get down to Arizona again soon.
That would be lovely. Try winter. Okay. You won't like it right now. No. Definitely in the winter will be a better thing. Maybe we can get Kensington to do some sort of winter program. I think
that would be great.
I'll talk to them about it. And Crooked Lane too, for that matter.
I'd love that. I would absolutely love that.
All right. Okay. Good night, everybody. So nice
talking. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.